Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, most Americans revere the U.S. Constitution, but some scholars say our problems in the U.S. may be rooted in that founding document. We'll dissect some of those provisions and the culture that keeps them in place. And first, is the U.S. Senate simply too weak to govern? Our next guest suggests it is. Peter Hansen joins us. He is professor of political science at the University of Denver. His book is Too Weak to Govern, Majority Party Power and Appropriations in the U.S. Senate. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Peter Hansen. It's great to have you back with us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Your new book, Too Weak to Govern, Majority Party Power and Appropriations in the U.S. Senate. You focused on appropriations as a means of sort of measuring this dynamic about power in the Senate. Why appropriations?
Well, that's a very good question. I think there are two questions that really motivated the book. If I can step back for a second from your immediate question, the major issue is that in the study of Congress, political scientists traditionally focused on the House of Representatives. And so we have many, many studies about the House and many books about the House, but the Senate was never very well understood. And so I was very curious to study the Senate and to better understand how strong the majority party is, how well it can influence legislative outcomes. What makes that challenging is that Congress considers different kinds of issues every year, and there's always arguments that maybe the individual factors of something going on in a particular year are really driving what happens in the Senate. And so what I needed was something that happens every year, something where I could look for reoccurring patterns over time. And that's the annual appropriations process. Every year, Congress has to pass a budget. It's supposed to do so in exactly the same kind of way by passing a dozen appropriations bills. So that made it a really good way to study the Senate and to identify change over time and to identify why that change might be occurring.
When you look at this over time, there was a historic trend that you saw. What was that trend?
Well, that's right. There are several important things that come out of the book. One of them is that our current budget process is really at a point of collapse. And to understand why that is, we really need to back up in time to the 1960s and 70s to see what was going on then and what changed. And essentially what's happened is as follows. Historically, Congress passed the budget by bringing a dozen appropriations bills that contain funding for everything from agriculture to defense to education. They bring those bills to the floor one at a time, and they would debate them, and they would amend them, and then they would pass them and send them to the president. And there were a lot of virtues with that process. It's a very open way of considering the budget. So when Congress brings the defense bill to the floors of the House and Senate, for example, members have a chance to debate it, to argue about programs, to offer amendments, to make changes. It's very transparent and it's very open. What's happened over time is that that process has broken down. In the Senate particularly, the majority party is no longer willing to bring bills to the floor on an individual basis. In fact, what they do instead is they often skip debate on those individual bills altogether. Then they wait until the very last minute, and when Congress is right about to leave session, and they bring a massive omnibus spending bill to the floor of the Senate. An omnibus bill is one that might package together all of those individual bills, all dozen of them, into a single bill worth perhaps $1 trillion. And then it pushes it through the Senate floor, really without any opportunity for debate and amendment. So it really shuts members out of the process, and I think it's a terrible way to make policy.
So this is actually a little bit of maybe manipulation of the appropriations process of how the Senate was originally thought to work. Would you say that's true?
Well, that's right. So to understand what's going on, I think we have to understand how the Senate has changed over time. And that goes right to this larger question of really how strong is the majority party in the Senate? Historically, you know, the Senate was designed to be the chamber where debate on great issues would take place. Members would come to the floor, they would give speeches, they would deliberate on major issues facing the country and make their decision. Well, basically, as the Senate has evolved since, you know, over the last few decades, that deliberative role has started to erode. And it started to erode for a number of reasons. Essentially, what's happened is that individual senators have become much more active in debating. They used to reserve themselves and debate only the weightiest issues. Now, every senator wants to debate everything, And second, the Senate's become much more polarized, so there's a lot more disagreement between Democrats and Republicans. The combination of those two things has really led debate on the Senate floor to collapse. It's become so difficult for the Senate to manage debate that leaders often aren't willing to bring bills to the floor at all anymore. And that's really the process I describe in the book.
So this is really done and decided on primarily by high-ranking members, mostly of the majority party, but they have to have agreement from the minority leadership as well, it seems.
That's right. So I think it's easiest to understand what's going on in the Senate if perhaps I give an example. So historically, of course, what happened is when Congress considered the budget, they would bring each of the spending bills to the floor for debate. When that happens today in the Senate, what happens is that the majority is just besieged on the floor of the Senate. It faces dozens of amendments. It faces filibusters. And ultimately, it concludes that it's just too costly to actually debate these bills. So last year, for example, Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, said, well, I'd like to bring the appropriations bill to the floor, but I'm only going to do it if Republicans will guarantee that we're only going to debate a limited number of amendments. And Republicans, of course, weren't willing to make that deal because for them, amendments are an opportunity to take positions, to force Democrats to vote on difficult issues, perhaps embarrass them in the run-up to the election. And Harry Reid, knowing that, simply said, you know what, we're not going to debate these bills at all. We're not even going to bring them to the floor of the Senate in the traditional way. Instead, what we're going to do is we're going to wait till the election's over, until the Senate is a few days away from adjourning, until the government is about to shut down, and then we'll bring a single $1 trillion bill to the floor of the Senate. And he counted on the fact that time pressures would be so severe that members would be worried about the government shutting down and so anxious to go home at the end of the session that they would just pass it without debate. And that's exactly what happened.
I imagine, too, with the thousands of pages that are in these omnibus bills, it would take a pretty diligent legislator to sit and read through them and mark them up and make the recommendations in any setting. So that can be a deterrent as well.
Well, that's right. I mean, most members simply don't have the time or actually the inclination to try and digest these bills, which can be several thousand pages long. And the net effect of what's been happening then as a result of this strategy of abandoning the traditional way of passing bills and shifting toward bundling together like this, is it's really hurt deliberative democracy. It has made it very difficult for senators to offer amendments, debate bills, as the way they've done in the past. It's actually astonishing to think that the Senate just passed a $1 trillion budget bill last fall without the opportunity for a single senator to offer even one amendment. Ironically, the House is doing a much better job debating the budget. House members debated and voted on over 100 amendments to the budget. But in the Senate, it's really collapsed.
Now, you said part of this is because of the structure of the Senate, as well as the new polarization. And so on grounds of efficiency, leadership is changing things around a bit. Structurally, of course, we have the Constitution. But you said there are also particular rules that make this almost imperative for the majority party leader to take away some of the debate. What are some of those rules?
Well, that's right. So really what makes the Senate distinctive are two rules. The first is that every member has the right to debate a bill for as long as they wish, unless 60 members of the chamber agree to stop debate. And the second is that members have the right to offer whatever amendments they wish. And in theory, this makes the Senate a chamber where you have the opportunity for rich, vibrant debate on the issues. In practice, what's happened in the modern Senate is that it's led to a kind of free-for-all on the Senate floor that's made it virtually impossible to adopt legislation. And so bills get to the floor and they are simply stuck in gridlock. The majority lacks the power to bring debate to a close. It lacks the ability to protect its members from voting on politically dangerous amendments. And so what it does is it tries to protect its members the only way it can. And that is basically by abandoning the traditional way for passing the budget and turning to these unorthodox measures instead. You know, the practice of bringing to the floor a single $1 trillion omnibus bill that it knows members won't have a chance to debate, but it at least gets the job done. At least it passes the budget. But all of that is really just a response to the very limited ability the majority has to control the floor of the Senate.
With the new leadership, do you expect it to be different from how Harry Reid conducted business with the appropriations?
Well, this is very interesting. Mitch McConnell, the new majority leader of the Senate, Republican from Kentucky, initially vowed that he was going to return the Senate to the old ways of doing business. He was going to bring more bills to the floor for debate. He was going to bring all the spending bills to the floor on an individual basis, just like they used to do in the past. And I was rather skeptical of whether he'd be able to do this. I think his intentions were fine, but I think in practice, this is very difficult. And so Republicans have started to try and do that. They've brought some bills to the floor for debate. But the fact is they've experienced exactly the same problem the Democrats did, which is that the Senate's rules permit unlimited debate in today's modern polarized environment that essentially translates into gridlock. And so I think Mitch McConnell is finding himself in exactly the same boat that Harry Reid was in, that he has things he wants to pass. He's not able to clear them through the Senate floor. And now he's starting to adopt some of the same tactics Harry Reid did to try and roll over that opposition as best he can and pass bills that interest him.
They have to pass a budget. They have to pass spending bills or else the government doesn't work. But it sounds like what you're arguing is there may be some sort of in-between that's not quite so undemocratic, but not so wedded to the efficiency of passing these things that you still get some transparency, some democratic process. Is there a middle ground?
That's right. Senate leaders have essentially found themselves in a terrible bind. And the bind is that they must pass a budget. And if they don't, the government will shut down and they will cede the political blame for that. And as we know from past experience, it's extraordinarily politically damaging to be blamed for a government shutdown. On the other hand, they face the simple fact that the Senate floor today is unmanageable. It's become so contentious and so gridlocked that it's very difficult even to pass budget bills that everyone knows have to pass. And so I think the question we face today is there some way we can change the Senate or reform it so that it could do a better job passing budget bills without turning to this really unorthodox tactic of passing last-minute trillion-dollar bills that no one has the time to read or scrutinize? My own recommendation here is I think we need to really seriously consider abolishing the filibuster. Filibuster is the rule in the Senate that essentially requires the majority to seat the votes of 60 members before debate can end in the chamber. The existence of the filibuster is really what creates gridlock on the Senate floor. It means that whenever there's too much disagreement, as is virtually always the case today, that no business will get done. I think this rule has outlived its usefulness. I think it's causing far more harm than good today, and I think it's simply time to get rid of it. That's not a conclusion I came to lightly. I worked in the Senate for 6 years. Much of that time was in the minority, and we valued the filibuster when we were in the minority because we felt it stopped bad policy from being enacted. But I think one of the conclusions I reached as a result of writing this book is that it's causing a lot of harm, and one of the things that's done has caused the budget process in the Senate to collapse.
Are there times in history that have been this dysfunctional in American politics, or is this fairly unique?
Well, you would have to go back to the late 1800s and the area really immediately following Reconstruction to find politics as polarized as they are today. Now, what's interesting about that era is that the House at that time had a lot of the same features as the Senate. In particular, it had rules which, like the filibuster, allowed the minority to bring the legislative process to a halt any time it objected to something that was going on. What happened in the House during those years was that the majority eventually became so fed up that it changed the rules, and it created the modern rules of the House that we still live with today that allow a simple majority to run the chamber and to suppress dissent. Now, it's no surprise to me that today when we're in a similar kind of situation in the Senate that we're starting to hear talk about reforming the filibuster. The Senate took first step that direction in November of 2013 when they abolished the filibuster for judicial nominees, and the pressure to reform it I think, is building, and I think justifiably so. I think we can't really allow a situation where one of the two chambers in our legislature essentially can't function.
Does the president play a role in all this?
Well, of course, my book really just focuses on the Senate, and then the president's a bit of a minor player in my analysis, because I'm mostly interested in understanding what happens on the Senate floor. But I did find some interesting things out about the role of the president along the way. One of them is that political scientists have never particularly well understood if the president is hurt by this practice of wrapping all the spending bills together into an omnibus package or whether the president benefits from it. My own conclusion is that presidents are effective negotiators and can really meet their goals no matter what path Congress takes. Ronald Reagan, at the end of his presidency, objected to Congress packaging bills together. In fact, he used his State of the Union speech to threaten that he'd veto the next one that crossed his desk. On the other hand, Bill Clinton loved it when he could sit down across the table from congressional leaders and negotiate over a single giant budget bill. If you read the internal histories from his administration, the Office of Management and Budget, which is responsible for budgeting in the administration, was essentially bragging about everything they won in negotiations from Congress while negotiating those bills. So I don't think there's a clear pattern that I found of presidents other than that they're effective negotiators and that they can meet their goals under pretty much any circumstances Congress throws up.
So in essence, what you're saying is that it takes these two elements more than anything else, the polarization and then these rules that are dictating the business of the Senate. Together, they're creating this really problem of anti-democratic policymaking. Something else you brought up was that the power or the numbers that a majority party has also matter. How much does that matter in context of the other two?
Well, the Senate has always been thought of as a chamber where individual members have a great deal of power. And, certainly my own experience working there for 6 years was that individual members can have a great deal of influence over policy. But I think, individual senators are now as much victims of circumstances as they are anything else. I think they're as frustrated as the country at the inability of their chamber to solve problems. And essentially what's happening here is that today's levels of partisan polarization combined with these very individualistic, flexible rules in the Senate, which permit any member the right to debate something for an unlimited period of time and to gum up the works by doing so. The combination of those two things has made it impossible for the chamber to get anything done. It's what political scientists call a collective action problem. It's when everybody pursues their individual interests and ends up making things bad for everyone else. And that's really what's going on in the Senate, that every senator is so determined to debate things and offer amendments that their combined effort of doing that actually ends up gridlocking bills and making it impossible to pass anything. And so really what we need to do is to change the rules of the chamber so that we can have a managed debate. We still need to give senators a chance to debate the issues, but we can't have the kind of runaway uncontrolled debate that's led to the kind of gridlock we've seen in recent years.
Most of this region has parliamentary politics, and a lot of Europe has parliamentary politics as opposed to the ways in which the U.S. govern. Have you done any kind of comparative effectiveness, democratic process with some of these parliamentary structures?
Well, that's not part of my book, but I think there's no doubt it is true that parliamentary systems make decisions much more efficiently than the American system. In a parliamentary system, as long as there is a majority, a bill will be passed. The American system is unique, and it was deliberately designed by the framers of the Constitution to make change hard. The United States is unique in that in order for a law to be passed, the House has to act, the Senate has to act, and the President has to act. These three independently elected branches all have to reach agreement. And that's simply not the way it works in a parliamentary system. I think that the question is actually whether our framers made it too hard for change to take place in the American system.
With all the multiple veto points that occur, even in the committee process often, and with so much power invested in party leadership.
You know, I think it is, it's certainly true that at least as you look at the American Congress today, it's very difficult for the Senate in particular to act. And it's one thing to have separation of power and checks and balances. It's another thing when one of our chambers has essentially become paralyzed by its rules. And so I think it's even harder for the American system to take action today than the framers ever would have anticipated.
So in the future, primarily, it's the rules you look at because polarization is pretty hard to address.
Well, that's right. I mean, my view is that there are some major features in the political environment right now that we simply can't change. American politics is going to be polarized for the foreseeable future. It took a long time for us to get to this point, and change, if it happens, will not happen overnight. And so I think we simply need to learn to live within this environment and enable our elected branches to make decisions despite the challenges created by this environment. And one way to do that is simply to make the Senate more efficient, allow a simple majority to take action. In the United States, I think that causes people a lot of concern. You know, the minority is always worried that if you get rid of the filibuster in the Senate, then the majority will somehow be able to do whatever it wants and put all these terrible policies into place. Well, that's what people in parliamentary systems live with every day. That's the way parliamentary systems work, is that a majority makes a decision. And of course, we still have separation of powers in the United States. There will still be a House, there will still be a Senate, there will still be a president. All of them will still have to agree in order for change to take place. So I really think that changing this one aspect of the Senate to make the Senate more efficient is not going to hurt us at the end of the day. We will continue on as a nation. We'll still, you know, we'll be able to make decisions more effectively. Certainly some people may not agree with the decisions that come out of the Senate, but that's the democratic process. A majority should be able to have its way.
The book again is called Too Weak to Govern, Majority Party Power and Appropriations in the U.S. Senate. Our guest is Peter Hansen, professor of political science at the University of Denver. Thank you so much for being with us, Peter.
Thank you, Maria.
When we come back, should we change the U.S. Constitution? That's next on the Scholar Circle. Stay tuned.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Women's History Month.
The dream that people can govern themselves, that we don't need princes or popes or high muckety-mucks, priests of any kind telling us what to do and making decisions for us, is now over 200 years old. And it is extraordinary how plangent that idea still is after 200 years. All over the world, people are willing to die for that dream.
Molly Ivins, American newspaper columnist, humorist, and liberal commentator from Texas. Part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. Funded in part by a grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. For more information, visit us at PacificaRadioArchives.org. Thanks for keeping our women's history alive.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Women's History Month.
Do the Constitution of the United States mean anything? Because we are a part of America. Our parents and our descendants was from Africa, and we didn't come on our own, but we do want to be treated as human beings. And I'm fighting for human rights, not for equal right.
Fannie Lou Hamer, 1917 to 1977, African-American civil and voting rights activist and founder of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, interviewed in 1965. Part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. Funded in part by a grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. For more information, visit us at PacificaRadioArchives.org. Thanks for keeping our women's history alive.
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. For decades, the U.S. Constitution has been treated as a sacred document that should not be criticized. But some scholars say that many of the provisions within the Constitution are at the root of the problems in the U.S. in governance, in policymaking, and in political discourse. What are the problematic provisions and how can they be addressed? We have three experts with us. Sanford Levinson is a professor of political science and law at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Constitutional Faith, Our Undemocratic Constitution, Where the Constitution Goes Wrong and How We the People Can Correct It, and most recently, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. Lewis Michael Seidman is also with us. Lewis Michael Seidman is professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University Law School. His books include Silence and Freedom, Our Unsettled Constitution, A New Defense of Constitutionalism and Judicial Review, and his latest on constitutional disobedience. Professor David Law is also with us. He is professor of law and political science at Washington University in St. Louis. He is co-author of The Declining Influence of the United States Constitution and The Myth of Imposed Constitutionalism in Japan. Thank you for being with us. We have two of you who have argued that the Constitution is archaic. And Michael Seidman, you have even said downright evil. Sandy Levinson, you've called it imbecilic and maybe even pathological. Some pretty strong words. I thought we should get to why we use such strong words, starting with a historic perspective. Michael Seidman, let's start with you here. You argue that the original framers really have no sense of what we're facing today. And furthermore, constitutional disobedience has helped the country grow and prosper. Give us some examples of this.
I'm happy to do that, but first let me just, maybe this a quibble, but I didn't say the Constitution was evil. I said there are some provisions in the Constitution that are evil. The Constitution also has lots of good things in it, and to the extent that there are good things in it, we ought to follow them not because they're in the Constitution, but because they're good things. But to the extent there are bad things in it, there's no reason to follow those just because people 200 years ago thought that they were good things. Now, in terms of the history of this, there actually is a long history in our country of skepticism about the Constitution. It really goes back to the founding. Certainly the anti-federalists who opposed the Constitution had lots of doubts about it, but some of the people at the Constitutional Convention had doubts as well. In the Federalist Papers, the phrase parchment barriers appears in a number of places. And what was meant by that was doubts that a piece of paper could actually protect basic liberties. On top of that, Thomas Jefferson was a complex and sometimes contradictory thinker, but throughout his life, he voiced deep skepticism about the constitutional enterprise. And the most important decision of his presidency, the purchase of the Louisiana Territory, he himself thought violated the Constitution. And a number of other great presidents, including Wilson, Lincoln, both Roosevelts, in one form or another, at one time or another, expressed pretty deep skepticism about the Constitution. So my own view is constitutional skepticism is as American as apple pie. It is part of our tradition.
Sandy Levinson, you've also looked at historic aspects of the Constitution and its strengths, its workability, when it seemed to work better for the U.S., when people were willing to talk about it. What would you add to this?
I think that the primary mistake we make is to assume that what by stipulation might have made sense 200 to 225 years ago really is good for us today. I don't engage in much of what I call founder bashing. I think that the people who wrote the Constitution were facing real problems and did the best they could. The problem is that we have tended to treat them not simply as wrestling with the problems of their own time, but as making decisions for our time. And I think that what is imbecilic is the way the Constitution structures our politics today and the extent to which we venerate the Constitution rather than engage in rational scrutiny. What I most admire about the founding generation was their ruthless attitude of rational scrutiny toward the Artists' Confederation and their view that they and we should always learn the lessons of experience. And I think that part of those lessons, a very important part, should be the extent to which the Constitution doesn't serve us well today, as well as, you know, the extent to which there may be some admirable parts about it. But I think that we are so inflicted with in a culture of Constitution worship and founder worship that there is nobody on the national scene who is leading any sort of serious discussion of the adequacy of the Constitution. And I think Mike made a very, very important point when he said that many of our most important presidents have, in fact, tried to lead national discussions about the adequacy of the Constitution. And that is what is wholly and completely lacking in our politics today.
What I'll want to get back to, of course, is even if we were to find these flaws, something that you've pointed out, Sandy Levinson, which is that it's nearly impossible to change it. One other note, you mentioned how much we are attached to this document. I think it was Robert Dahl who called it a civic religion, that people treat it like a religion. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes. The first book I wrote was called Constitutional Faith, and it really tried to develop the religious overtones that are attached to the Constitution, I think much to our detriment.
This is Mike Seidman. If I could just add to that, I've had some personal experience with this just over the last week or so. I wrote a column in the New York Times that made many of the points that Sandy just made so ably. I've gotten over 1,000 emails since then from many, many people who acted as if I had attacked their religious beliefs, that I was attacking God and the Bible. It was just really an extraordinary reaction. And what's so puzzling about it to me is I would have thought some propositions were really just, to coin a phrase, self-evident. And one of them is, this is our country. We live in it. We have the right to have the kind of country we want to have. Nobody would be happy if France told us what kind of country we had or the United Nations told us what kind of country we should have. So it seems very odd that people should feel so strongly that these folks who lived over 200 years ago, who know nothing about our current life, who are all dead, and who probably did not represent a majority of the country even when they spoke, that they should have this kind of dictatorial control over fundamental aspects of our polity. It seems really strange that anybody should think that, much less that they should feel so strongly about it.
I would say part of those may have also come from the headline the New York Times gave your piece. I think that scares people.
This is Sandy Levinson. If I can jump in for just one moment and offer a slightly different perspective. The Times published my op-ed, and they called it our imbecilic constitution. And I got a lot of the same kind of responses that Mike is describing. But I would also emphasize that there was a decent percentage of responses of the type, kind of, finally, I thought I was the only person who thought there was something screwy about the Constitution and the power it gives small states in the Senate, or the difficulty of change, or the Electoral College, or some of the other problems. A number of people have pointed out that currently roughly 20% of the American population describes themselves as religious non-believers, but they're really almost frozen out of the public discourse because every at least elected political leader seems to feel some necessity to indicate religious commitments. So I think that there is actually some portion of the population that might be open to a serious discussion of constitutional inadequacy, but our elected political leaders, including the two Harvard graduates who ran for president, are providing no leadership whatsoever in having any kind of discussion about what a 21st century constitution might look like.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're exploring America's reverence for the U.S. Constitution and how to address the problems that arise from it. And that's something we should talk about in a bit as well, but let's bring in David Law. Professor Law, you have looked at this constitution in a comparative context. How do others deal with this, and how does the U.S. Constitution fare in the course of history?
Other countries are much more serious about revising and updating their constitutions than we are. It's a bit ironic that the U.S. pioneers this idea of self-determination by committing oneself to rules and principles that are the result of rational self-deliberation. Let's get together and write a constitution and actually put down on paper how we think things should work. And then we turn around and we're the one country that actually doesn't ever really do this anymore, right? So Jefferson urged we should have a constitutional convention every 19 years. That actually turns out to be the average lifespan of a constitution. The average lifespan of a constitution is 19 years. Ours is 225 plus years and counting. So faced with the fact that our constitutional operating system is equivalent to Windows 0.1, other countries see and recognize this, and they look at the formal document and they go, look, even if we wanted to copy the American constitutional system, we would not start with the document. We would not take this large C constitution. Instead, we might look at their small C constitution, which includes, you know, their judicial opinions, it includes their statutes, it includes their practices, it includes their conventions, but we certainly wouldn't adopt this thing that they've got called their constitution. So one thing that's clear is other countries don't consider the document as it currently exists a good template. And I think given that we have this old unamended document that doesn't even describe what we do, you know, doesn't mention political parties, which are fundamental to our system. It doesn't mention the administrative state, which is fundamental. It doesn't mention the concentration of power in the presidency, president now being directly elected. You know, there are two options that make sense, right? We could actually try to revise the Constitution and address its most glaring defects, which Professor Levinson and others have urged at length and in various works, including Sandy's book, Undemocratic Constitution. That's one option. A second option that's reasonable is we could give up on the idea that the Constitution sets forth binding legal rules that address contemporary disputes and view it instead, as Mike urges, as a work of art that is designed to evoke mood or emotion rather than a legal document that commands specific outcome. Whether or not one agrees with Professor Seidman's position, whether or not we agree that we should detach from the Constitution, if we don't fix it, if we don't update it, we are in fact going to increasingly detach from the Constitution. Whether or not we agree with this prescription, what he's describing is in fact going to happen increasingly. So what I think all three of us agree on is that relying on the current Constitution in its current form is a non-starter, but we seem to be stuck with that thanks to some combination of ancestor worship, treatment of the Constitution as civic religion, and the sorts of things that Sandy's mentioned. Pretending we're governed by this thing, this U.S. Constitution, rather than this larger mass of things, the statutes, the conventions, the understandings, Supreme Court decisions, that's a legal fiction. You know, it's really an act of ventriloquism. It's getting the document to say what nine justices want it to say, right? That's not really the Constitution. Don't look at, I think Mike likes the expression, the man behind the curtain, right? So what you see front and center on stage is the large C Constitution. That, as a descriptive matter, that's no longer the way that things are done. And other countries recognize that, and that's why they don't use the U.S. Constitution as a template anymore.
This is Mike Seidman again. If I could just add to that, I think David is absolutely right that one of the problems here is a kind of willful blindness or hypocrisy about what's going on. But there's another problem also that neither David nor Sandy's mentioned, and that is that our addiction to the Constitution tends in an unhelpful way, I think, to raise the temperature of political debate. Think, for example, about gun control, which is a subject that Sandy has written more perceptively about than anybody, I think. The issues about gun control are authentically hard, and people feel strongly about them, and of course there's going to be argument about it. But what happens when the issue is constitutionalized? Well, that has two really unfortunate effects. One effect is that means the lawyers get a hold of it, which means the lawyers do what lawyers do, which is to say they read the text very carefully and they look at the history and try to figure out the connection between the English Declaration of Rights and the Bill of Rights and so on. And they end up talking about stuff that's profoundly irrelevant to the issues today about guns. But the other thing that happens is once it gets attached to the Constitution, then we're not just having a policy disagreement or even a disagreement about philosophy. We're having a disagreement about the nature of the United States, and people start accusing other people of violating our foundational charter and so not being real Americans. And this is a serious obstacle to having the kind of discourse that in a rational, mature democracy we ought to be having about issues that matter.
So what you're saying is it's having a silencing effect.
I'm not sure silencing is quite the right word. In some ways, it's the opposite. It causes people to start yelling at each other instead of listening to each other.
This is David Law. But just add, I agree completely with the point that Mike is making. The constitutionalization of public policy disputes is democracy stunting. Rather than folks, you know, I was born and raised in Canada, and if you have a policy issue in Canada, you ask yourself, what makes sense? What should the country do? What should the government do? Increasingly, the same sorts of questions come up in the U.S. in the form of, well, what does the Constitution command or forbid or require? And if the idea of democracy is we're supposed to be responsible for ourselves, we're supposed to engage in self-determination. Instead of engaging in self-determination, we engage in this pseudo-historical inquiry into what we think people might have had in mind 225 years ago. That is not democracy.
Sandy, I heard you coming in. Sandy Levinson?
Yeah, I agree with both Mike and David. I think Mike makes a very important point that lawyers take over the show, I think generally to our detriment. For me, the worst example of this has to do with the issue of impeachment. I happen to think that one of the real defects of our political system is that we can't fire a president in whom we lose confidence. During the Clinton administration, obviously, we went through this charade of impeachment, and it turned out to be lawyers fighting one another about the meaning of high crimes and misdemeanors, instead of having what might have been a more cogent discussion of whether Bill Clinton's behavior had simply so disgraced the presidency that he should have the decency to leave, as would have happened, I think, say, in Great Britain, or whether, to take a much more telling example for me, whether one had really lost so much confidence in George W. Bush as the commander-in-chief that he should be fired. We can't have that discussion because there is no procedure for a vote of no confidence. Instead, lawyers shout at one another about impeachment, I think, to our detriment. And as Mike said, with regard to gun control and with regard to so many other issues, this is the way too much public discourse proceeds in the United States. I'd like to make one other point, a kind of modest disagreement with what David Law said. One of the real anomalies of American constitutional politics is that we venerate the United States Constitution and find the idea of a new constitutional convention almost literally unthinkable. But if you look at the American states, there have been over 225 constitutional conventions over our 200 years. Each American state has had an average of nearly three constitutions. So if you look at the practice of Americans at the state level, you find kind of a marvelous willingness to treat constitutions instrumentally, to ask how do they need to be updated, to amend them. Indeed, the usual critique that a lot of people have about state constitutions is that they're too easy to amend. But it does seem to me that Americans have a curious sort of schizophrenia, where at the state level, we've been remarkably creative with some frequency in revising constitutions, and at the national level, we're really stuck in the late 18th century.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're exploring America's reverence for the U.S. Constitution and how to address the problems that arise from it. Sandy Levinson, let me engage you on this just a bit because of the gridlock that you have written about, and I think that some of the other professors have also. Some people argue that the gridlock is, to some extent, a good thing because it acts to prevent bad laws from being enacted, especially in light of the way the interest group power has grown in the lawmaking process, and it prevents certain majorities from oppressing minorities or limiting their rights in some way or another. But even with the states changing their constitutions under the umbrella of, say, the Bill of Rights, which, as we know, did not come with the original Constitution, but it prevents those states from violating rights, like we saw some in California, for example, but it is now traveling to the Supreme Court. So do you see any good in the gridlock?
It's undoubtedly true that the harder it is to pass legislation, and at the national level, it is almost incredibly hard to pass legislation at times, it's going to block some terrible legislation. But it will also block good legislation, and I think that we have to decide ultimately what we fear more, which risks we're most obsessed by. One thing we learned from an early age in America is to be almost obsessed by the problem of tyranny of the majority, and therefore to say, well, the way to prevent tyranny of the majority is to make it very, very difficult, at times nearly impossible, for the majority to govern. That does, in fact, protect us against those majorities that want to be tyrannical. It does nothing whatsoever, however, to protect us against minority tyranny. That is a tyrannical status quo, whether it's slavery, patriarchy, or other kinds of examples that we could give, where the near impossibility of change simply freezes into a kind of permanence an unjust status quo. Frankly, I would rather run the risk of having legislation passed that I really don't like and then rely on the next election to throw the rascals out and repeal their bad legislation than to continue with a system that makes it nearly impossible to confront any of the great issues that face us in the 21st century, whether you're on the left, right, or center, that each of us has a menu of issues that we really have to confront. And I think that one of the things that unites the Tea Party with the Occupy movement today is the well-merited belief that if you look at Congress, they're incapable of responding adequately to any of these issues. This is one of the things I think that accounts for the fact that Congress has an approval rating these days of about 12 to 15%.
Before we dig more into this, I really would like to hear from David Law how other countries and other constitutions deal with these kinds of issues.
I would start by saying that most countries have a more healthy relationship with their constitution than we do, in the sense that they are willing to work with it and they do not fetishize it, put it on a pedestal. Most countries approach the document more as a functional thing, a thing that sets forth how the government's supposed to work and is a framework for government, and rather than something that they're afraid to touch, something that sort of exists behind plexiglass, museum glass. And that means that constitutionalism in other countries looks like constitutionalism, as Sandy described, at the state level. Other countries are willing to revise their documents on a fairly frequent basis. So they don't have to read into the Constitution things that aren't there. In terms of the fear of tyranny of the majority, a lot of countries have the opposite concern, which is the fear of what the French call gouvernement des juges, you know, government by judges. There are a lot of parliamentary systems in the world that are premised on the idea of a more pure democracy, one that can't be stopped by the judges. Who elected the judges anyway to say what legislation can or can't be passed? But the trend is toward increasing acceptance of judicial review and increasing willingness to allow the judges to enforce the Constitution. If there is a global trend, it is in fact in favor of allowing the courts to limit the scope of legislation in the name of the Constitution. But that's less dysfunctional when you're willing and able to revise and update your Constitution on an ongoing basis. If you actually work with your Constitution and you update it, you're not tying yourself to what people did 225 years ago. You're tying yourself to decisions you made maybe 10 or 20 years ago, which is vastly more reasonable.
Michael Seidman.
You know, it seems to me when you asked Sandy how you balance majority against minority tyranny, you asked him exactly the right question. And the point I'd like to make is the problem with constitutionalism is that it takes that question off the table. So when Sandy talks about the fear of minority tyranny, he's very persuasive. And when I've listened to him, I think, you know, he's probably right. When I hear other people on the other side, I have some sympathy with them also. This is a hard question, and it's one we need to grapple with. But as long as you have Constitution worship, we can't even talk about it, because the Constitution, for better or worse, sets up a system, and the assumption people have is that we're stuck with it, and therefore it's not worth talking about changing it, or worse yet, if you even think about changing it, you're some kind of commie un-American. And so we never get to the hard and important questions that Sandy has written about in his last two terrific books.
Where do we go from here? Sandy Levinson, you have talked a bit about doing some kind of constitutional convention. You've talked about ensuring that you leave out particular kinds of people, namely the Congress. How would you see something like this going?
Unfortunately, almost any answer sounds quixotic, precisely because there is no national leadership and there's no mass movement. That being said, what I would hope is that people would realize that we really do need to confront the Constitution as a whole. And the best way to do that by far is in a new constitutional convention. And the Constitution itself contemplates the possibility of new conventions. There is a procedure by which Congress must call a convention. I think Congress can call a convention at its discretion. One of the reasons I would exclude Congress is Congress has more than enough that it needs to be thinking about. So one of the reasons to have a constitutional convention is precisely so you could have a group of people who would have the time to debate one another about what sorts of institutions would well serve us, and then to make proposals to the country. I find my own ideas quite reasonable, but I also think it's quite obvious, as I say, that there is no movement that is pushing them, and there is nobody at the national level of politics who's really willing to take any sort of lead. And that's what I find so completely dispiriting, that you have pundits across the political spectrum who increasingly describe the American political system as dysfunctional, even pathological, but they're unable to connect the dots and to say that the Constitution makes its own contribution to the dysfunctionality of the pathology.
You mentioned the money and politics issue, and that does seem to be the issue that might bring another amendment forward. The president himself has said he would support an amendment to overturn Citizens United.
This is Mike Seidman. Finally, I think you have a little disagreement between the three of us. I'm not in favor of a constitutional convention, and I'm not in favor of constitutional amendments. Just as I resent people who died two centuries ago ruling us, so I don't think we have a right to rule people two centuries from now. And the problem with a constitutional convention and with amendments is that, again, they are efforts to entrench the status quo. So the one sort of amendment I would favor, or the first business of a constitutional convention, if we're going to have one, would be amending Article 5, which provides for amendments and making it much easier. But even if that were done, I think a lot of the pathologies that we've just identified would also attach to trying to write a new constitution. I don't think we need a constitutional convention. I think we need a change in our culture. Now, how do you bring that about? Sandy's right. Anything you propose is certainly going to sound quixotic, but cultural changes happen at the ground level first, and we could all start the process by the next time somebody says to any of us, that's unconstitutional, we should say in response, so what? And if enough people do that, then people are going to start wondering, so what? And then a lot of things that don't seem possible now might suddenly become possible.
David Law, was that you coming in?
Yes, if I may. I agree with Mike that amending Article 5 would be a great idea, making constitutional amendment a little easier. We know as a matter of actual empirical data that constitutions that are too difficult to change, that are too rigid in a sense, don't have the same longevity as constitutions that are a little more supple. Now, obviously, the U.S. Constitution has done a great job, even though it's been very rigid. But on the whole, a little flexibility, not too much, but a little flexibility turns out to be good for constitutional longevity. Now, if you make the Constitution easier to change, then the difference between the Constitution and a regular statute becomes a matter of degree rather than a matter of kind. Countries have this document called the Constitution, but it's not entrenched. So there are really, you know, two separate questions here. Do you want to change the Constitution or ditch it? And do you want the Constitution to be entrenched?
It's a perfect place to end. Let me thank the three of you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Sanford Levinson is a professor of political science and law at the University of Texas at Austin. His books include Constitutional Faith and, most recently, Framed, America's 51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance. Lewis Michael Seidman is professor of constitutional law at Georgetown University Law School. His books include Silence and Freedom and his latest on constitutional disobedience. Professor David Law is professor of law and political science at Washington University in St. Louis. He is co-author of The Declining Influence of the United States Constitution and The Myth of Imposed Constitutionalism in Japan. Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Cuauhtemoc Aleman, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @Armudian. See you next week.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Women's History Month.
When we talk about the contributions that poor women, poor black women made, we're not supposed to acknowledge them as having been agents of history, and certainly not of having played a role in shaping what we might call feminist historical traditions.
Angela Davis, African-American civil rights activist, author, and professor of the history of consciousness at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. Funded in part by a grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. For more information, visit us at pacificaradioarchives.org. Thanks for keeping our women's history alive.
The Pacifica Radio Archives celebrates Women's History Month. Flora Moulton, blind street singer from Washington, D.C., talks about her music and sings, "I Can't Stand It," from this 1976 WPFW interview.
I wrote this song one night. Now, I'm going to tell you something about that, my songs that I write. I write songs about myself, and I write songs about history of things then. I can't stand it. I can't stand it.
This recording is part of American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. Funded in part by a grant from the National Historical Publication and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. For more information, visit us at pacificaradioarchives.org.